Cleveland Neighborhood Progress is changing how it funds community development corporations, or CDCs, for the first time in decades. They say the old way just wasn't working and was underfunding certain neighborhoods. The organization is confident in this more equitable way of funding CDCs, which do everything from throw neighborhood street festivals to repair real estate, basically anything that promotes the growth of the community. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll speak with a representative from Cleveland Neighborhood Progress and two CDCs about this new funding model and how it could better help residents. Later, a conversation with David Gilbert, president and CEO of Destination Cleveland and the Greater Cleveland Sports Commission, about the events happening in Northeast Ohio: the Solar Eclipse, the Women's NCAA Final Four, the Cleveland International Film Festival, and more. Those conversations coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us. Cleveland Neighborhood Progress, an organization that helps fund the city's community development corporations, announced this week its next round of funding for the 2025 fiscal year will be about $2 million across 17 CDCs. Seven of those CDCs are being funded for the first time. Policymakers and civic leaders will often point to these CDCs as being the organizations that most directly work with their residents on issues ranging from economic development to affordable housing to safety concerns. This year, CNP, Cleveland Neighborhood Progress, revamped their funding model in an attempt to be more effective and to more equitably fund the city's CDCs. Today, to kick off the program, we will talk about how the funding model from CNP has changed and why that matters for residents. We'll also dig in more specifically into some of the work undertaken by CDCs. And later in the hour, stay with us. I talk with David Gilbert, head of Destination Cleveland and the Greater Cleveland Sports Commission. We'll look ahead at everything that's happening in Northeast Ohio this weekend. And as you probably all know, it's a lot. Finally, another episode of our music podcast shuffle. But first, to begin our hour, let's talk about CDC funding and what this means for neighborhoods and residents. I am joined by Jason Powers. He's the Senior Vice President of CDC Advancement and Resilience at Cleveland Neighborhood Progress. Jason, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us this morning.
Also joining me, Joy Johnson, the Executive Director of Burton Bell Carr, a CDC focused on Cleveland Central and Kinsman neighborhoods. Joy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, we have Lucas Reeve. He rounds out the discussion as Executive Director of the Old Brooklyn Community Development Corporation. Lucas, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
And if you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, you can call us, 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Jason, I'm sure many of our listeners might not know the ins and outs of this whole funding system. So explain to us first what Cleveland Neighborhood Progress is, where it gets its funding, and ultimately how it becomes an instrument for funding for these CDCs.
Yes. So Cleveland Neighborhood Progress is a nonprofit intermediary, which is a term that basically means we sit in between the foundation communities of Cleveland Beyond and the CDC network that supports all of the different communities in Cleveland. Our responsibility is to steward the funds from the philanthropic partners, provide technical assistance, advocacy, all of the types of resources that CDCs can't always provide in the neighborhoods. We then come and supplement.
And tell me who these philanthropic partners are and why, you know, back in the day, they decided giving to these CDCs is important for us to corral our money and make sure that they're funded, in part because I know that they're getting block grants as a big chunk of their funding as well.
Yeah, the story of Neighborhood Progress began in 1988. Corporate funders as well as a philanthropic community really set aside this idea that across the city at the time, there were over 40 of these CDCs, ranging from fairly substantial organizations to two persons that were not even professional staff. During the 90s and 2000s, different funding streams were developed. The major funders and the partners are Cleveland Foundation, Gunn Foundation, Mandel Foundation, Key, as well as Rocket Community Fund. And it's because of these incredible sponsors of our work that we've been able to provide consistent funding. And that's the key. It's consistent, flexible funding. So in order to provide services to neighborhoods, and as a nonprofit, in an ecosystem where you are using federal funds, which are always tying your hands behind your back, relying on changing economies from the private sector, macroeconomics that are well beyond what a neighborhood organization can face, like the housing crisis in 2007,
sure.
You need to be able to rely on some sort of backbone source of funding. And that's what these dollars have been doing.
Okay. And I want to know, you know, historically and kind of looking at it from a 30,000 foot view, what have been some of the highlights and successes as far as the funding going to the CDCs and how it's helped neighborhoods?
Yeah. So the funding system that we are just now evolving from, it's been operating for about 20 years. When it was first developed, the system was about twice as large as it is today. And the idea was, let's find a handful of organizations and some neighborhoods and very strategically invest deeply. Major successes. We see them in Detroit Shoreway and in Ohio City. We see them in Glenville, just north of University Circle. These areas were targeted. The investment was consistent, and we were able to see them move the needle. Since then, over the last 20 years or so, we've seen a lot of consolidation in our organizations. And of course, when we had the Great Recession, the epicenter of the housing crisis in Cleveland, we realized that the changing model that we had needed to be able to look different for the CDCs that were changing.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a second, but I want to bring Joy and Lucas in. Joy, how has Burton Bell Carr utilized funding from Cleveland Neighborhood Progress over the years?
As Jason said, the money being flexible, more flexible than some of the federal funding that we received, we've really been able to utilize those funds to grow. It has helped us grow into a new neighborhood, and didn't mention in the introduction, but we also serve the Buckeye neighborhood, which is newer in the last 5 years or so. We've also been able to have more than one office location. And really, another place where we've really seen a sweet spot is that it's been able to help us really dive deep into our health and wellness programming, which a lot of other funding sources don't necessarily cover.
And how do you see your CDC as kind of this front line of service for residents in the community?
Well, what we do, we develop relationships with the residents to learn what their needs are. And so as a CDC, we can either try to meet those needs through real estate development or through partnerships. So being that connection, that voice, that, you know, as a neighbor, really, and maintaining those connections is really where it all starts. And we don't try to meet all of the needs, but we try to connect folks when we can.
And Lucas, I'd ask the same question for you. Essentially, how do you see Old Brooklyn CDC functioning, and how has the funds from CNP played into some of your successes?
Yeah, I think a lot of the core work that CDCs are engaged in is around housing, economic development, building community. And so the dollars that have come in from CNP have really helped to bolster the work that we do in all of those areas. But I think, as Joy mentioned, the flexibility of them has allowed us to explore other areas that are critically important to the neighborhood. And one that I would highlight is around bringing people together through events. Our organization does quite a bit of events and programming throughout the neighborhood. And as a neighborhood, the
large— Give me an example.
Yeah, so a great example, our farmers market. So, and maybe we'll get into a little bit of this later, but we look to make interventions in the neighborhood, look for gaps and ways that we can fill them creatively. And so the farmers market that we run every summer is, number one, designed to be an intervention from a food insecurity perspective. So our market continues to be one of the highest uses of SNAP and WIC throughout the community. It's located on a main commercial corridor, so highly accessible from a transit perspective. But more than that, it just brings people together in the summertime, right? Who doesn't love going to a farmer's market? It's a place to gather on a Saturday morning, spend some time, grab some vegetables, grab a coffee, visit some of the other businesses along our commercial corridor. So some of the money that's come in from CNP over the years has helped us to build our capacity in that area. And now we're actually shifting to not only doing our own great events in the neighborhood, but helping to provide pathways for other folks that have upstart events and initiatives with the supplies that we have to help get them off on a good start.
So, Jason, now the funding model has changed. And I know one important aspect that I think our listeners might not be aware of, isn't 80% of the money that the CDCs are getting are from block grants? And those are very rigid and bureaucratic, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. Kind of tell me how hard it is to use those funds in any way that these CDCs want, and kind of the gap that CNP fills with its funding.
Yeah, so the Department of Housing and Urban Development provides CDBG, Community Development Block Grants, to cities across the country. They're used in various ways. And in Cleveland, we have a history of using them for each ward to allocate to nonprofits. And the CDCs typically are the ones that are operating those dollars.
Sure.
Those dollars are primarily meant to support low and moderate income households. In Cleveland, we have a lot of low and moderate income households. And so they are able to use these in these areas. But just like with any grant you might receive from the federal government, there are extraordinary reporting requirements.
Yeah.
They take up a lot of time, and they also make it very difficult to use the dollars. So at the end of the day, we actually have residents and business owners who don't use our programs because of how difficult it is to use those dollars.
Wow.
So providing more flexible dollars, general dollars, whatever we can provide, allow us to sometimes fill in those gaps and make sure that every resident has some sort of program accessible.
Okay, so let's talk about your organization and this new model and why you think it's better, more effective, and more equitable.
So Neighborhood Progress, as I said, is an intermediary. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the key is that we're not a funder. The funders provide us generously with these dollars that we steward. And so it's
sure.
our responsibility to find the best way to use those dollars. Historically, those dollars were given in ways that, you know, made a lot of sense in sort of the big picture of finding places and investing and trusting the organizations. But they were never really reflecting the exact needs, because we never assessed the organizations in a way that would tell us what the needs were.
Mm-hmm.
Organizations will set missions and goals and strategic plans, but Neighborhood Progress didn't say across the city of Cleveland, how well are we doing? And so we first designed a diagnostic. We call it the advancement model. Every single CDC in Cleveland went through it this fall, and it's a scorecard. It's a way of saying, how are we doing? And we actually heard back from the organizations that a lot of them liked the exercise, as arduous and long as it was, because it gave them a sense of how are we doing in our neighborhoods? Where are we weak? And so in the history of grant making, where it's typically competitive, this was collaborative. This was saying, here's where we need support.
Sure.
And then we designed a grant program that simply says, those gaps, those areas that you need support, we're going to support them.
And so my understanding is that, again, with the older model historically, certain neighborhoods were deemed as the hot neighborhoods, that if you grow the community and give it more prosperity there, it's good for Cleveland as a whole. So there was a pocket of haves and have-nots when mm-hmm. it comes to the CDC. Am I reflecting that correctly?
Yeah, it's been said by a lot of people, but recently it was explained that, you know, the late, great Mort Mandel shared with the leadership at the Mandel Foundation how critical it was not to spread the peanut butter, right? That's what we say. We don't have enough resources in Cleveland. We can't spread the peanut butter. And that's absolutely true. And so the difference in this new system is that while we are sharing the funds with more organizations, what we're also doing is we're finding much more specific ways to invest. Every single CDC at this point represents a very large community. And so every single organization needs to be able to do the uninteresting things of their have board governance, have good fiscal responsibility. They need stability in a changing community. And from there, we believe that all the organizations can then support their neighborhoods better.
Okay, so one aspect of the funding model that I thought was good is that every CDC sets their top priority. Whatever they think they need the money the most for, they get. Is that right? And that way, every CDC is funded for their number one priority. Joy, what do you think of that aspect of the funding model?
I think it was a smart decision. And I think the CDCs already knew what their priorities were, but not everybody had the opportunity before
right.
to say, CNP, fund me for this top priority. So I think the prioritization isn't as innovative and different as the fact that everybody got a chance to put their hat in the ring, so to speak.
Yeah, I've got to assume, was it creating a bit of resentment and a feeling of, you know, the system's not working if there are CDCs in certain neighborhoods that were just kind of left out of the picture?
Yeah, that was a big part of what we heard back in 2019, 2020, right before the pandemic hit. We were sort of at a breaking point. Trust was really waning.
Sure.
So it, you know, people saw it as winners and losers and competition. In fact, the grant system, you know, the way it had been developed was that you had to put your best foot forward. And so organizations that had been winning it consistently typically had the resources and the know-how to put together the best grant applications.
Sure.
If you're an organization, take, for example, Harvard Community.
So you're building strength on strength.
Exactly, mm-hmm. which yeah. is a strategy. strategy.
Sure.
But for example, right now, Harvard Community Services Center in the Southeast Side, right? So the mayor has a new focus on the Southeast Side. It is an incredible service center supporting its community. But to develop its community development skills, real estate, business support, it needs a runway of support. It wasn't receiving it, and it wasn't therefore in a position to earn it. And so now we're changing that.
And then what is the application for the weakest part of each CDC? Is that getting funding as well?
That's right. And so the three areas that we chose to fund were, first, we trust what the CDCs say is their number one responsibility and their number one priority, so we're going to fund that. We're going to use this scoring system I was describing before to take whatever they applied for in the lowest 25% capacities and say, look, these are your weakest areas. We're going to invest here.
Sure.
And then last but not least, we relied on our relationships with the CDCs to have conversations directly with them and learn about areas that we could fund. By funding the weakest areas, our goal is that year over year, we can see what success looks like, how many dollars are needed to move the needle, and then iterate and do better.
Okay, so I'm curious, Lucas, what is your top priority at your CDC, and what's your kind of, I guess, weakest link?
Yeah, great question. I think, so our top priority was around marketing and communications. We do a tremendous amount of that.
Tell me what that means.
Yeah, so it's really part of our overarching strategy around community engagement. And so we really think of almost everything we do as community engagement, right? If you're at the farmers market, you're engaging with the community.
Sure.
We have a quarterly print magazine, which is a great opportunity for us to tell the stories of Old Brooklyn, engage with people in that way. We've just launched now an online version of that magazine. So now that magazine is coming out every month. And so for us, being able to tell the story of the work that we do within our community so that folks understand how they can better interact with us and access the resources that we have. But then also really just generally telling the story of what it means to live in Old Brooklyn. This is important to us to help build the sense of community. It's also important to us to help attract new businesses, attract new home buyers to the neighborhood. So for us, investing a lot of money and being able to have a really strong marketing and communications program and a really strong community engagement backbone was critical to us. I think building off Jason's point for a moment as well. I think one of the things that we found through this process is that typically a CDC's number one priority and maybe some of their bottom, more weaker areas were the areas where funding didn't really exist to build capacity in any of those areas.
Sure.
And so CDCs would find themselves doing those things in the middle consistently because the funding was there to do that, but knew that we had weaknesses that we needed to improve
upon. And would never address.
Exactly. And so now we have, with these flexible dollars, the ability to continue doing those things in the middle that we know from a housing and economic development perspective that are critically important in our neighborhoods, but now we can focus on those top priorities that we understand and start to build on those weaknesses to increase the capacity to do more in the neighborhood.
Joy, what is Burton Bell Carr's top priority that you're getting funding for?
So again, as I mentioned before, our priority that we're funding highest is our health and wellness programming.
Okay.
And so especially with the changes at the Sisters of Charity Foundation of Cleveland and the loss of St. Vincent Hospital in Central, they were a big supporter of our health and wellness programming, and they're not able to do that as much anymore. We worked actually with Old Brooklyn CDC in 2022 to conduct a community health needs assessment where we talked to residents at the grassroots levels to find out what their health needs were.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have a playbook of what we can design our health and wellness programming around to meet their needs. But we really need that staff support to actually implement it. And so the dollars from CNP will help us do that as a highest priority. But it also is just keeping the doors open, and not to be very blunt about it.
Yeah.
But we do receive a large chunk of community development block grant funding. And as we've expanded, we work with three council people, Council President Blaine Griffin, Councilman Richard Starr, and Councilwoman Deborah Gray. So it's great to have access to all of those resources, but that means three times the processes, three times the bureaucracy, three times the amount of time that it takes for money to get into the doors. And so having the CNP dollars again, making them be more flexible, just helps us to be able to continue to do the work from day to day.
And Jason, it's my understanding that seven CDCs that have never received funding are finally in the mix. I mean, I'm sure you've been talking with them, and are they feeling seen, or are they feeling you know, revitalized to take part?
Yeah, definitely seen. I got a few messages right after we made the announcement of from board members, actually, of those CDCs who were so excited about it. And it's not just a combination of being seen in the form of dollars, but being in this process with your peers and feeling like you are part of a network. We're never going to have enough money to do all of the work we need. So we're going to need to lean on each other. So whereas Old Brooklyn supports BBC in their community health needs assessment, taking the expertise they've developed in public health and supporting another neighborhood on the east side, we want to make sure that real estate, business development, marketing of neighborhoods, we can build those capacities and share them. And the only way you can do that is everyone collaborating instead of competing.
So I'm curious, we're talking about these block grants that do serve, you know, a big source of the funding for these CDCs and how rigid they are. I was reading that there is talk about how can we provide more funding that is as flexible as what CNP's providing.
Yeah. There's a process going on that being led over by City Council to explore what it would look like to be able to take those dollars that come from the federal government and use them still in the budget of the city of Cleveland, but replace those with general dollars. General dollars that come from the city will still come with contracts and oversight, but much less restrictive ones. And as long as we can find good ways to use the federal dollars to still do things in our neighborhoods, which other cities across the country do, then we'll be able to find the more flexible dollars, because the CDCs do just about everything under the sun. No matter how much we want them to be able to focus on certain areas, they're the first line of defense, as you said earlier. And so they do need that flexible dollar.
And you've touched on this, but how much feedback do you get from residents? I mean, what's a random request that you get from residents or that you're fielding that you kind of feel that you are the local representative for the residents in your communities? I'll ask you that, Lucas, and then I'll go to Joy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole myriad of ways that residents engage with us. I mean, it's really an ongoing thing. And they reach out to us in multiple ways, right? I mean, folks are calling us, emailing us. It's not uncommon at all to have someone just show up at the office and need help with something. And it could be something as easy as pointing them in the right direction to access a resource, or sometimes they come in, it's a really challenging situation that they're dealing with. Wow. You know, we have folks that come in with housing insecurity issues where they're worried about where they're going to sleep that night. And so it becomes something that all of our staff help them to find a safe place to stay and hopefully can get on the track to safe, secure housing in the future. And so it's a whole myriad and whole gamut of things, but it's happening all the time. And it happens out in the community, whether it's at an event. It's ongoing.
Enjoy, same question.
Yeah, I ditto that. Housing, we would get as number one. Folks are constantly coming in. They know the CDCs for creating housing. We never have enough housing. Yeah. How can I get on your waiting list? And it's not, we have folks who are housing insecure on a spectrum, right? So not necessarily emergency housing, but sometimes they're living in housing, but they want better quality housing. They're interested in home ownership, but they're not sure how to take that first step. So I would say our top concern is housing. And then because we serve several neighborhoods, each resident is always saying, what are you doing in my neighborhood? You're doing so much in the other neighborhood. So we hear that all the time as well.
So you're doing some managing as well.
Yes, yes.
All right, Joy Johnson with Burton Bell Carr, Lucas Reeve with the Old Brooklyn Community Development Corporation, and Jason Powers with Cleveland Neighborhood Progress. I appreciate seeing all three of you and having this discussion with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
All right, time now for a quick break. On the other side, we preview what's expected to be a pretty busy weekend in Northeast Ohio. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. It is gearing up to be a busy couple of days here in Northeast Ohio. The Cleveland International Film Festival just got underway here at Playhouse Square. The NCAA Women's Final Four kicks off Friday night at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. The Cleveland Guardians home opener is Monday, and the Cleveland International Film Festival is going on as well, as I just mentioned. And oh yeah, there's that little eclipse thing that'll plunge Northeast Ohio into darkness on Monday afternoon. It's a moment for Northeast Ohio to shine with thousands of visitors descending upon the region in the coming days. Let's now spend a few minutes talking about everything that's happening this weekend. And with me to do that is David Gilbert, President and CEO of Destination Cleveland and the Greater Cleveland Sports Commission. David, thanks so much for joining me today.
Good morning, Jenny. How are you?
I'm well. How are you feeling with, I don't know, maybe one of the biggest weekends in Northeast Ohio in a long time?
Yeah, it's incredible. And things are just honestly off to such a great start with the teams coming in, all the activities. You're really starting to feel the excitement downtown. And each day is only going to get bigger and better.
Yeah, I like the tweet from Iowa player Caitlin Clark, who tweeted, "Cleveland, here I come," and you could just feel, like, just from my Twitterverse, all the excitement about the Final Four coming to Cleveland. And I know that they had or are having a big kind of welcome rally.
Well, there's a number of things. We had team welcomes to make sure that when their planes landed, each of the teams, that they felt the Cleveland love. And last night, not open to the public, but they had a big event where they welcomed the teams. They're all together and let them have a party. Other than that, honestly, the players themselves and the coaches, they're here focused on winning the national championship.
Of course.
So they're not out in public, but we are going to be seeing the tens and tens of thousands of people who are here to root them on, all starting to show up today and tomorrow.
And what does the Final Four mean for Cleveland? Ticketing, hotels? I've got to assume there's a lot of visitors coming in just for that.
Oh, yeah. I think that the impact is on several levels. So
okay.
One, certainly the economic impact. We're doing an economic impact study that will have the results probably 60 to 90 days after, but probably will be somewhere $25, $30 million in just new direct spending in Cleveland or more because of how significant this championship is. But, you know, it's also, Jenny, the things you're talking about with Caitlin Clark saying, "Cleveland, here I come," you know, there's so much incredible national media attention that's going to be coming to Cleveland, far more than we ever could have imagined when we were awarded that event 6 years ago. We knew it was going to be big, but, you know, it is at meteoric levels. And I just think the civic pride, you know, for Cleveland, oftentimes you know, it's something that is hard to put a price tag on, but critically meaningful, particularly for, you know, a city that over the past couple of generations, quite frankly, has dealt with some of those issues. And you know, there isn't anyone on the street in our community that doesn't know this is coming, that isn't excited that it's in Cleveland. It is very possible that if the finals end up being LSU in South Carolina, it could be the most watched sporting event in America
Iowa
this year, other than the Super Bowl.
I know you meant Iowa when you said.
Sorry, I meant Iowa for sure.
All right, let's talk about another star, or the sun being eclipsed.
Good one.
That was an impromptu transition. We're hearing estimates ranging from 50,000 to 500,000 about the total amount of people coming to Ohio for viewing. I mean, that's a big range, but what are you thinking? What are we bracing for? And what is kind of the impact both civically and financially from the total eclipse that we're expecting Monday?
Yeah, you know, we were obviously very fortunate that we were gifted this huge event. You know, Women's Final Four, we had to win a big competition to get it. It really is hard to predict the number of people. And again, we're going to do the best we can. We have we're going to be doing a study and do the best we can. What we do know is millions of people every year, when there is a total eclipse, travel to be in the path of totality. And we've been working very hard for several years on putting together coordinated community plans to try and make sure that Cleveland gets more than its share of those travelers. I think you'll have a lot of people after Women's Final Four that know it's coming will be staying. We'll have lots of people coming in for the day, some coming in for the night and going to Eclipse Fest and other things. I think it's fair to say it will be in Northeast Ohio, tens and tens of thousands of additional people, maybe even more than that if you're talking about day visitors. We'll know after, a little harder to predict than a Women's Final Four where you have an arena that's full. Safe to say it's an event that in and of itself should mean additional tens of millions of dollars to our local economy.
Absolutely. I want to read a touching email from Lucy of Seven Hills, who said, I want to mention that last year on April 8th, my father turned 100 years old. He died 6 weeks later, and we told him we would remember him on his next birthday, April 8th, 2024, during this special eclipse. To me, it is darkness followed by light. Oh, my God, I'm going to cry. And reflects hope. So, Lucy, have a poignant and beautiful eclipse, and say hi to your father. I'm being moved right now. So,
beautiful.
Let's talk now about the Cleveland International Film Festival. I'm going to be moderating a panel for a screening of Maestra on Saturday night at Playhouse Square. It's at the KeyBank State Theater. That documentary is about women conductors in the classical world, but it's really more of a documentary about women in the workplace. It's a really good one. I'm very excited. That happens every year, but somehow we've got this trifecta or quafecta of all the big events happening.
Yeah, it really is amazing. It's funny, all the people who are spending a lot of time with from out of town were just telling them, yeah, it's a typical week in Cleveland. Obviously not the case, but I'll give you a great example with that Maestro. We met 6 months ago with the folks at the film festival who we know well, said, hey, the Women's Final Four is coming the same week. You know, if you want to do some things that are particularly poignant for the audience coming in, will help promote it. So I think it's been wonderful how groups have been working together. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has a special exhibit on women that rock. So I think it's not just these individual events that are all fortunate to be happening around the same time, but we're the kind of community that works together and figures out how we make 1 + 1 equal more than 2. And I think you'll have a lot of people coming in for the Women's Final Four who will make their way to the film festival. And you also have Guardians opening day on Monday.
So exciting.
It really is going to be an absolutely incredible week in our city and a very impactful one from a financial and perception standpoint.
Yeah, and another kind of synergistic thing that seems to be happening, the Cleveland Orchestra is giving a performance at the Great Lakes Science Center following another screening of that documentary, Maestra. So, all of these great powerhouses of Cleveland and Northeast Ohio working together to kind of give what seems to be a really celebratory weekend for Northeast Ohio. I mean, you talk about civic pride in the sense of like, we got stuff going on and the nation is taking notice. I mean, really, 2016 and the Cavs winning the championship, I mean, that was probably the moment, right, of civic pride. But this feels like another example of that.
Yeah, Jenny, I do liken what is happening right now to 2016. And, that was just a magical year with the hosting of the Republican convention and, having nothing to do with politics, but Clevelanders were so prideful that we were hosting a national convention and it went so well. And then, as you said, of course, the Cavs winning the championship and the Guardians going to Game 7 of the World Series. And I think there's a lot of parallels to that magical year with what's happening over this week and into next week here. And then some other big events that we have later this year. We have the Pan Am Masters Games for the World Masters Olympics. First time ever in the U.S. We're expecting, well over 10,000 people from all over the world. There's already people from 50 plus countries and almost every state that'll be coming here. And some other major events coming to Cleveland. And I really do believe that, you know, 8 years from now, people are going to look back and be talking about 2024.
Okay, let's just quickly talk about any pressure points, any thoughts of concern, you know, if you were kind of to tell our local listeners and people that may be coming in, you know, just how to be kind of responsible participants in all these activities.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is have patience. You know, we've done this before. We've had days when you had a Browns home game at the same time as a Cavs game or at the same time as a Guardians game. This community knows how to handle major events. I just say, you know, give yourself a few extra minutes. Know you may pay some extra money for parking. So think about taking RTA downtown. You know, Eclipse, you know, there's going to be, unpredictable traffic getting to and from bigger spots to watch the Eclipse. I think other than just a little patience, I would tell you also, I encourage people, even if you don't have a ticket to the Women's Final Four, there's a ton of free activities. There's a free open practice on Saturday for the teams. There's a free big fan fest called Tourney Town at the Convention Center. There's a big, you could still get involved in the basketball bounce for any kid 16 and under, sort of a parade marching downtown on Sunday morning. And it's going to be an electric feel. The people coming in, the fans coming in for this Women's Final Four are going to feel unlike any other event we've had coming in. They are going to, their spirit for their school is going to be off the charts, and you're going to feel it. Come downtown Saturday and walk around when there's no games. Just be around it. Go take things in. And honestly, I'd say most importantly, be proud of your city. Be proud that your city is the center of national attention over this week.
Yeah, and we covered the Eclipse yesterday, and I think this applies to all events. You know, if you've got a lot of people for one event, you know, that staggered exit from an event might help reduce traffic. That's something that ODOT mentioned yesterday, and that's a good reminder to our listeners. David Gilbert, head of Destination Cleveland and the Greater Cleveland Sports Commission, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Jenny. Thanks for having me on.
And have fun this weekend.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Time now to take a quick break. On the other side, another installment of our music podcast shuffle. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for spending the hour with us. 4 years after the start of the pandemic, musicians continue to emerge from a time of loss and insecurity. Cleveland's Jenna Fournier is one of those musicians. On this week's Shuffle, IdeaStream Public Media's Amanda Rabinowitz talked with Fournier, who records experimental electronic songs as Kid Tiger.
Salted sea, I swallowed it down. Endlessly, I swallowed it.
Jenna Fournier says when her shoegaze rock band Nights was on pause, she started writing and learning to record her own songs under the name Kid Tiger and is getting ready to release her debut solo album.
2020 hit and I decided I'm going to record this at home. I had started listening to a lot of bedroom pop and I had already been sort of enamored with the idea of lo-fi self-produced music. 2020 was just when I was like, now's the time to do it. I took some online classes for audio engineering and recording and just started the bare basics and started the beginning and worked my way up.
How long did it take you to really learn and master how to do this at home on your own?
Truthfully, it was about 3 years. And obviously when someone says, oh, I worked on this record for 3 years, I didn't work on it every day for 3 years. But over the course of 3 years, I was taking classes, experimenting, and then ended up, instead of making what I thought would be a very stripped down acoustic and sort of tiny sounding lo-fi album, I started incorporating all these electronic elements and it just became what it is.
The album is fantastic, by the way.
Thank you.
And it's called?
It's called Stoned and Animaled. I loved the metaphor of stoning as being judged. You put yourself out there as an artist and people judge you. And the more vulnerable you get, the more it seems they judge you. So that mixed with Animald, which Animald is my way of explaining survival mode, which I think a lot of us felt in 2020. But if you're someone that has dealt with a lot of abuse and trauma, you definitely understand survival mode. Mm-hmm. So I kind of crushed those two ideas together. Taste from you holding the needle, but you, what would you do?
What was the first song of this record that you started working on?
Skin. I had a very early demo of Skin.
It's such a classic track to me of something that started probably very simple and then you just kept building on it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the process of producing it?
It's exactly what you said. I actually wrote it on a looper. It's probably one of the first songs I wrote when I first got a looping pedal, which if anyone's not familiar, that's a pedal where you can record a couple bars of music and then play it back and you play on top of a loop. So when you're writing with a loop and the loop is just going, you're stuck within the perimeters of that loop. The way that you make it more interesting and shift into a chorus or shift into a bridge and take the song sort of away from home, which in songwriting I try to think of as like you have a home. When you want to get into a bridge or something different, you leave home for a little bit, but then you come back home. That's your hook of the song, right? So you have to sort of do that melodically or do that with layers and texture and building and then stripping back down. So that was sort of my approach to Skin, and it ended up being an approach to a lot of the records really once I went into production mode, was sort of this layering and then scraping away and layering and scraping away. I wanna wear my skin.
I think Skin is my favorite song on the album, and can you talk about the message of it?
It seems to be getting very universal feedback where people are understanding that it's about feeling alienated in yourself and losing that sense of self. You become sort of dissociative. You're kind of looking at the world through a piece of lace or a haze, and including looking in the mirror with a piece of lace over your eyes, or the world sort of becomes a blurry photograph. I think Skin is about trying to reclaim that clarity. I think people are picking up on it because it's done in a way that it's vague enough that everyone can put their own story into it. And I don't need your sympathy.
What made you feel alienated in the song Skin?
Well, I was in a very abusive relationship that started off as just emotional and verbal abuse, and it became very physically violent. If you don't deal with things right away, they just sort of fester. And a ton of these songs kind of came about from navigating that through art and through music, because I didn't go to therapy. And I love my parents very much, but I feel like my family response was to not talk about ugly things. And I don't blame them for that, because I know exactly what that is, because I did that to myself too. It's this idea that being strong means you sort of stand up, you dust yourself off, and you move on. And you tell yourself, I'm being strong. I'm going through my life every day. I'm not thinking about this stuff. I don't have to let this stuff affect me, but it's sort of operating in the background and it's sucking up your CPU power. And one day you just kind of wake up and you start recognizing these patterns and you're like, oh crap, I gotta deal with this stuff.
That's so similar to my life. It's ridiculous.
It's similar to, I think, anyone that's gone through it, it is almost textbook. And I think part of why it's important to share this stuff is because so many people have, and because it's hard to talk about.
When did you start therapy?
2020.
2020, that was when? For
yeah.
The first time in your life?
Yeah, I bought myself therapy as a birthday present that year.
Wow.
I think 2020 it stripped so much from me. Everyone had their own losses, and whether it was a death in the family or, you know, your loved ones fighting over all of the things that were dividing us that year, or relationships falling apart and crumbling, or your career being turned on its head. I had all of those. Had all of them. So it was just too much for me. I'm definitely in a better place because I have the space in me to try to help others again. I didn't have that space to help other people. And that's when you know, like, things are bad. And that's part of that being a stranger in your skin, is where is that space that I used to have for other people? When you find that again and you have that space left, you're not animaled. You're not in survival mode anymore. Thanks.
The first track of the album is Therapy.
It's the first track because it's kind of the most rockin', but starting off with Therapy as the title track is also sort of, let's set the ground, here's my thesis statement, right? In a way.
Can we talk about a few more songs?
Yeah. PTSD is kind of a fun one to talk about because it's another one that I think the title is just like, bam, it's very aggressive and in your face. My favorite line on the record might be from PTSD. The line is, I say it every day, calm down, everything's just fine. I say it every day, so it must not be a lie. And it's about convincing yourself that everything is okay when it's not. Calm down.
Shapes of Water. It stirs up emotions, just the sonic layers of it, I think.
Shapes of Water is one of my favorites. It was my first single. I guess there is a little bit of an FU to the modern world of 2.5 minute singles and catering to the streaming services. I did kind of want to lead with a 7 minute single. I'm here with art and a message. I'm not here to play your algorithm game. It was something that, because it's one of the first pieces I completely produced from the ground up, from home, it felt very much like, here's a little taste of what I can do from home. Before this, I'd only really made studio albums. And I did end up mixing it in a studio, and we added live drums in the studio, but otherwise it was all done from home. So it was kind of it felt like a good launch for me. I take yours here then.
The album, as it progresses, it gets more experimental as it goes on.
Yeah, I think embracing experimentation is definitely the spirit of this record, sonically. And then, you know, lyrically, it's dealing with the stuff from the vault. It has really been the biggest help through the years to write these songs, process things by journaling and by workshopping and by feeling this music. I don't have a huge audience, but the people that are listening sometimes tell me things that these lyrics mean so much to them. They're helping them. They didn't know anyone else ever felt this way. Even at such a small level of an artist, I'm already hearing stuff like this from people.
Every song is just a new journey, I feel like, and it's beautiful. Congrats.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for having me.
That's Jenna Fournier, who records music as Kid Tiger. You can hear more of our conversation and follow the podcast at ideastream.org/shuffle. I'm Amanda Rabinowitz, IdeaStream Public Media.
Shuffle is your backstage pass to Northeast Ohio's independent music scene. Thursdays here on WKSU and The Sound of Ideas. You can hear all previous episodes of Shuffle by subscribing to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at JennyHamill_ or on Instagram at JennyHamillIdeaStream. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable. This week, Mike McIntyre is joined by Glenn Forbes, Kabir Bhatia, and Haley B. Miller from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Monday on the show, we'll bring you the latest broadcast of the Sound of Ideas Community Tour that was held Monday at the Great Lakes Science Center and focused on the total solar eclipse. Be sure to tune into that. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast where you get your podcasts. You can also hear a rebroadcast of tonight's program, tonight at 9, on 89.7 WKSU. For now, I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I will speak with all of you next week.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rood, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.